This podcast is sponsored by Shame Space. Perhaps you've heard of the meditation app Headspace, which provides hundreds of meditations for you to listen to in order to be more mindful. Well, this is all New Age demon spawn, which will lead you down the slippery slope from mindfulness to full-on baby-sacrificing Satan worship. In order to avoid the wide-open gaping maw of hell, try Shame Space instead. Shame Space provides you with hundreds of fundamentalist preachers screaming at the top of their lungs, "What a horrible, deceitful, immoral, sin-filled pile of crap you are." These God-ordained men will remind you how without Christ to inhabit your soul, you are nothing but a meat bag flesh suit that will rot like a possum carcass on the side of an interstate superhighway. An interstate superhighway headed to hell. You will be reminded that God loves you so much that Jesus had to be tortured and suffered a violent death, suffocating, suspended on a cross in some backwater of the Roman Empire in order for you to avoid the righteous justice of God, which seeks to send you into a fiery pit of eternal torment. God may love you, but all it takes is for you to blow it, even by one little stray sinful thought, for God to make sure you will be tortured forever by demons who make Hannibal Lecter look like some kind of hipster vegan sipping soy milk while trying to determine which bean curd to eat for dinner with their Cookie Monster stuffed animal life partner. The Headspace app may offer you the sounds of waves or whale calls to help you wind down and sleep at night. Shame Space offers you the sounds of demonic hordes falling upon the souls of the damned on the shores of the Lake of Fire. Those souls may have thought watching a little softcore bodice ripper on Netflix was okay. But now they know their lustful thoughts led to an eternity of demons using a grinder app, which doesn't contain pictures you can swipe to get lucky. Rather, they swipe to get the picture of torture devices to use on your fornicating soul. Stop spending time and money on a New Age meditation app that will lead you to hell. After all, the road to hell is paved with App Store purchases. Instead, let shame keep you from sinful actions like getting a COVID vaccine or studying critical race theory or impure thoughts like how good LeBron James' arms look in the new Space Jam movie or how looking at those MeUndies ads on Facebook make you feel all warm and fuzzy inside. Instead, use Shame Space, 100% guaranteed to keep your eternal soul out of hell. Money-back refunds only available after a customer has in fact died and gone to hell. Hey, Save Me podcast listeners. Well, last episode I asked if they COVID pandemic and government assistance really was causing people to rethink their lives, their priorities, and staying at their jobs. I guess all the stuff predicting a mass job exodus were sort of right. The stuff I've been reading focused on white-collar types working from home or moving to Lake Tahoe to work remotely. But it seems like the people really rethinking things were all the hourly workers asked to risk their lives in the pandemic for crappy wages and crappy treatment. Everywhere I go, there are help wanted signs and restaurants seem understaffed and stores don't have enough help. I guess if you give people just trying to survive on poverty wages a chance for a breather, they stop hustling and opt to quit playing a losing game. Whoever you are, white collar, working from home while your kids drive you crazy, or hourly worker, wondering why you're working so hard for so little, I hope you're finding something to save you these days, to keep you going. Something that helps you realize that there is more to this life than your job. Something beyond the grind. I'm working on finding my something, whatever that is, but I sure wish somebody would just hand it to me. I'm getting tired of the search. Here's what I'd love to know if you have bothered to listen to this podcast. If you're figuring something out with your job, can you touch base with me? Reach out. I'd love to hear what you're doing to figure out what work means to you, what life means to you, what is fulfilling, what is meaning, what gives you the kind of life you want, because hearing your stories might very well help me. Well, out here in the Midwest, we are being forced to don our masks again. When Kansas City Mo put out another mask mandate, I was really pretty pissed, not at the mayor for making me wear a mask, but at the thousands of idiots in Missouri and Kansas who won't get vaccinated, who have turned the middle of the country into a hot zone of death. It's nuts. I live on the Kansas side, so I'm only a few miles, 2.5 maybe, from KC Mo, where there's a mask mandate. And where I live, there is not one, which is insane. I'm pretty sure you can look around and see the people putting on masks when they go into stores and the like are probably already vaccinated. And the people who are not wearing masks are probably not vaccinated. I just don't get it, and I don't know what to feel. I'm just pissed off. I find it really hard these days to feel compassion for these folks because I have no idea what kind of mindset says no to the vaccines. I get it. You don't like the government or anybody telling you what to do, but come on. Is it worth it? When did science get political? Maybe science always was political, just like everything else, and there's certainly been awful stuff done in the name of science. But, I mean, once upon a time, we trusted some kind of authorities. I don't know, man. It's like we all watched the X-Files in the 90s, and suddenly we just wanted to believe and wanted to trust no one. Well, since the last episode, I had a surprise letter in the mail. It came from Michael Jones, with whom I went to high school in Virginia. Mike apparently likes podcasts a lot and gave mine a listen, and for reasons I don't get, has still been a faithful listener. Hey, Mike. Usually he's one of the first people to tune in. In his letter, which was way encouraging, he enclosed a check to support this podcast. It was significant, a lot more than I deserve, and I was shocked. Michael was a guy that when I first met him, when I moved from Missouri to Richmond, Virginia, in the middle of high school, I was just sure I would not like him when I first met him, or rather saw him from across our English class in our junior year. He had a late 90s punk vibe going, a punk band t-shirt, sort of an alternative haircut that like he just didn't care, a leather jacket. He was in a band. He was a class clown, hilarious, and he was popular. I was a devastated junior in high school, devastated because I had moved across the country, and I was clinging to my conservative Christianity like it was the only thing keeping me from drowning in despair. I was lonely and felt really alone, and Mike seemed like the opposite of me. He seemed like a guy who knew who he was and was anything but alone, and I hated him. Of course, it was all about me, not about Mike. I just felt threatened by him and jealous, and like most people you don't like in life. It's all about you and where you're at, not them. Over time, Mike and I began to sort of run in similar circles, and he began doing forensic speaking competitions, which I was also into. I had always thought he was seriously funny, even though I didn't want to admit it, but I was shocked to discover that he was also kind and friendly. And although he had a pretty good act going, pretending not to give a shit about anything, he was actually a genuine human being. Michael was one of those people that did not compute into my careful categories of good and bad. My judgmental nature was a blunt instrument that Michael and pretty much everybody else easily evaded and confounded. Over time, I learned to admit that my initial judgments of him were all about me. Jealousy of his popularity, and he seemed not to care what others thought, while I cared way too much. Jealous that he seemed to know his place in the world, while I felt lost. And I finished my 2 years in Virginia, graduated, and intended to never go back. Michael went to Virginia Tech and became an actual professional economist. And me, well, you're hearing about me. Thanks to the glorious and holy righteous app that is Twitter, Michael and I connected again. And he began listening to this homemade podcast. At one point, you know, I DM'd Mike and asked, why did he listen to this podcast since it had to do so much with religion? And in my memory, Mike had been quite vocal about all religion being bullshit. I mean, people change over a lifetime. I certainly have. I wondered, had he found Jesus or Allah or Buddha? And he replied that really he was listening because he liked the story I was telling and that I was trying to be honest. And he felt moved that I and my family were going through a difficult time. He liked hearing a Christian offering what he said were sane words in an insane time. All I can say, Mike, is that I'm humbled that you listen, that all of you listen, that any of you listen. It really intrigues me that there are a number of people that are faithfully listening who are agnostics, maybe even consider themselves atheists. But that's sort of been the whole way that my time as a minister has gone. I've always seemed to attract people who swore they didn't believe anything. And in general, I usually found those people who believed less about religion to actually be more compassionate and more Christ-like than all the people who wore Christ's name and around, calling themselves Christian. And I get the feeling Mike is that kind of person. And that irony of people being Christ-like, even though they don't claim the identity of Christian, is not lost on me. And this is an episode where it's sort of all about that, about how my categories that I was raised with, and that after a time, I can't blame my family for. These were categories that I adopted and doubled down upon, even becoming far more conservative than my evangelical parents were. The categories of my being right and everyone who thinks like my brand of religion is right and everyone else who doesn't is wrong. Man, that really comforted me in so many ways. But yet, as in the case with Mike Jones, you know, there were all sorts of experiences with people along the way that opened up my perception of the world. And so in this episode, I'm going to share some key moments that helped me to move beyond my limited worldview and that helped me to at least start seeing shades of gray. And so I hope that's interesting to you. You know, I keep thinking in this podcast that I'm going to need to fill it with content. And, you know, for my first year or so, I was doing interviews with people, and I began to actually sort of get better feedback from folks who just wanted to hear me share what was going on with my journey. I don't know if that's the right way to go or not, but it may be just a narcissistic journey down my own ego. But as I process this, I hope that my journey is meaningful to somebody else. I wish I could get these podcast episodes up faster. Obviously, from the low production value, it's not that difficult to do. What is difficult is being in the right mindset to think up ridiculous sponsors or to have thoughts I want to share. I mean, truth be told, I wish I could somehow do this full time instead of having all my brain power sucked out through my job and other stuff. If I could only bottle up my anxieties and use them as an energy source for creativity, or somehow if I could bottle my anxiety and sell it and make money, maybe that would fix things. But my mind seems on permanent overload trying to figure out where I am in life right now. And it just feels like I'm trying to do one of those 5,000-piece puzzles, but somebody has dumped it out on the floor, and the dog made himself sick eating half of the pieces that I'm never going to get to fill this puzzle together. So I don't know. Who knows? But I'm trying to figure this out. My wife says I need to take a step of faith and open myself up to risk and really following my passions. How I feel is like the world has an awful lot of people out there that think they have something worth saying, and a whole lot of white men out there talking, thinking that what they have to say is important. And so I'm not convinced that what I have to offer is particularly marketable or on brand. I don't know. But at least it's fun, and it's something for me to think about. Enough rambling. Thanks for accompanying me on the journey. Thanks for being a part of this. And listen, I'm still puzzling out some things about my faith journey. I don't guess I've ever stopped. But one of the big things I'm struggling with right now is once you make the shift from a closed mindset where your little pocket of evangelical Christianity is right and everybody else is wrong, into a worldview where there are many truths and there's a whole lot of mystery, what kind of Christianity are you left with? I fled from an evangelical Christianity to liberal Christianity, thinking it held all the answers, but it took getting fired by a very liberal church for me to admit that what I had been experiencing for years, white, middle-class, liberal Christianity, as a whole is an empty, lifeless thing. Yeah, there is a concern for social justice and communitarian values, but it looks a lot like passive MSNBC viewers when it comes down to praxis. It comes down to feeling that we are superior to those idiots over there, and that's enough. And when you're white and you're middle class or above and you think you're liberal, you don't really need to wrestle with the difficulties of race and class and wealth and poverty and inequality that truly destroy this culture, or at least not in any way that is embodied or sacrificial, not in any way that makes us uncomfortable. In its own way, progressive Christianity, with all its outrage, is really no different than evangelical Christianity. Each side has God in its pocket, a controllable deity that works according to rules which align with our own biases. Each side claims to care about people but never really does anything about the real problems in our world. I'm still searching for a faith that matches passion with reason, heart and mind, and actually changes me into a better person and less of a lazy asshole. So as you listen to the rest of this episode, don't make the mistake of believing that once I left evangelical Christianity, I found what I was looking for among the progressive Christians. I believe I just found a different brand of empty religion. And maybe if you're on the atheist agnostic end of the spectrum, you would throw up your hands and say, see, it's all bullshit. But I'm not there. For me, I feel like there's still something, and I'm still on a lookout for it. Hey, this podcast of mine, the Save Me Podcast, has a Facebook page, a Twitter account. You can find it on anchor.fm/save-me-podcast, which is what I use to send this sucker out into the series of tubes, which is the internet. And you can find it on iTunes, Spotify, other places. Hey, make a review. If you review it, let me know, and I will read your review and comment on it and tell you how awesome you are on my podcast. So like it, follow it, do whatever, or don't. You can make a donation via the anchor.fm site, or don't. Hey, thanks to Jimmy Haas for editing this audio. Jimmy's another one who's been a supporter along the way, and I feel like I'm unworthy of his grace. Don't remember, go and buy Jason and Dina Hobbs' book, When Anxiety Strikes, Help and Hope for Managing Your Storm, because I had a great interview with them, and I lost the interview, but you can buy the book and read it, and it's good. Hey, if you make it through this episode, I really would like to hear from you. Did anything at all mean anything to you? Did it suck? Should I hang it up? Should I keep going? I just want to feel like somebody's out there and this is fun for me and meaningful, I dare say. So I'd love to know what you think. And I'd love more to hear what is saving you right now. I could use some pointers. I could use some advice. So be good. Don't be anxious like me. You've got a lot to be grateful for. Just take a minute and start listing all the stuff that you're thankful for. And you realize this life can suck sometimes, but it can be beautiful. This week, I'm watching the crushing images from Afghanistan, yet more disaster in Haiti, and you just think this world is fucked. But I have to believe it's more than my privilege talking, that there's still beauty in this world. And so I hope that you can find it and tell me how you found it. You know, focus your energy on that stuff that you're grateful for instead of all that other crap. You'll feel better. And I try to do that whenever I feel like crap. I just stop and I think about what it is in my life that I didn't earn and that doesn't have to be there, but somehow magically is. Usually it's people, but it's also stuff like the food I eat, a roof over my head, sunshine, birdsong, my family, my dogs. There's beauty in the world. And the only way I've figured out how to be aware of it is gratitude. Look, just a thought. I've got no answers. There's a lot of people peddling stuff who are more experienced and more spiritual than I can. Just trying to help your daily commute. Just remember, if you're looking for something to save you, you've got the wrong podcast. There are so many people out there answering questions and offering answers, and I don't have many. Maybe none. I'm just looking for somebody to save me too. This podcast is brought to you by Croaksbury Books online store. Are you a dying mainline church in need of transformation without your members having to sacrifice anything or change anything about the way they've done church for the last 75 years? Then Croaksbury Books is the online bookstore for you. We at Croaksbury have seen recent controversies regarding who is worthy to take Holy Communion. Normally, we don't carry products for Roman Catholics out of a righteous concern of being drawn into a papist conspiracy involving one world government. However, we respond to the needs of churches, even ones that teach works righteousness, especially when those churches' needs involve high profit margins for us. So we are proud to announce we are now carrying the St. Jude Sin Scanner. If your local Catholic parish is concerned about some baby-killing politician taking communion, simply install the St. Jude Sin Scanner today. Resembling an airport metal detector, congregants simply walk through the sin scanner, which will detect any baby-killing tendencies. A loud alarm will sound, and the sinner in question can be tackled to the ground before they make it to the priest to receive the host. Please note, the manufacturer of the St. Jude Sin Scanner has ceased production of all scanners that detect sins other than the sin of supporting abortions. There simply wasn't any demand from Roman Catholics. Models are no longer carried, such as the consistent pro-life model, which had settings not only for abortion, but also detection of people who support the death penalty, war, capitalism that increases child poverty, opposition to fighting climate change, and/or denying access to medical care for everyone except those who truly deserve it. As we said, Catholics no longer care about such things. Conservatives and fundamentalist Protestant churches can look forward to sin scanners coming this fall for them. Are you concerned about Christians taking communion who might be rhinos, Republicans in name only, and don't believe President Trump rightfully won the 2020 election? Or perhaps you are worried there might be people in your church who support teaching critical race theory in schools? Just install the sin scanner near your Lord's Supper table and let your worries melt away. By Christmas, we should have handheld Protestant sin scanners too, so you can wave them in front of the lady parts of your female church members to detect fornication. Please note, handheld sin scanners do not work on male private parts. Also coming in the fall, sin scanners for liberal and progressive Protestant churches. Designed to match the classical architecture of your sanctuary, the liberal sin scanners don't actually do anything, since sin is an illusion of the mind, and communion is nothing more than a relic of primitive, violent religious tendencies of an earlier, more ignorant age. You can order these sin scanners now at crokesbury.edu via our temporarily non-accredited online Bible College bookstore website. Remember, for all your book needs, we are glad to send you ebooks because we do not have a nationwide fleet of delivery vans like Amazon.com. We are in the process of putting together a nationwide delivery system made up of old church buses. You know, the church buses, which are really poorly painted obsolete school buses, and unsafe 15-passenger church vans. The type of van sitting unused because church insurance companies declared them a rollover risk. And remember, by ebooks, we mean books our unpaid interns from our temporarily non-accredited Bible college typed into state-of-the-art Commodore 64 computers and printed out on our daisy wheel dot matrix printers. Please allow for an extra week for us to rip off the perforated edges of the paper provided. The extra handling fee has been paid, of course. These hard copy ebooks will be delivered to your home or place of business by Crazy Mike, who is illegally squatting in our warehouse and enjoys hitchhiking across the country with hundreds of pounds of paper strapped to his back. Please note, Crazy Mike will arrive at your home tired and hungry, therefore a night or three of lodging and copious amounts of canned meat may be required. Please be respectful of Crazy Mike's personal boundaries and his need for the continuous playing of the 1962 novelty song Monster Mash by Boris Pickett in order to remain calm and nonviolent. Please note, the 1964 cover version of Monster Bash by the Beach Boys seems to enrage Crazy Mike and sends him in search of plastic jack-o'-lanterns to desecrate in unmentionable ways. Do not taunt Crazy Mike. Try Croaksberry today. Growing up in the Southern Baptist slice of evangelicalism, I wasn't exactly living in a hotbed of religious pluralism. Essentially, it meant experiencing varying degrees of white conservative Christianity, ranging from a well-intentioned commitment to getting everybody in the world singing Jesus Loves Me, all the way to Jesus is going to burn the world down, apocalyptic fascism. In the late 70s and early 80s, the moral majority had not yet succeeded in achieving a monopoly on the political imagination of Southern Baptists. It was still possible in some circles to find people who voted Democrats. There was still a desire for evangelizing the world, which took priority over partisan politics. Political issues of the right or the left were a bit too this world-ish and less important than getting as many souls into heaven as possible before Jesus came back and shut the door for good. By the late 80s, however, republicanism began to eclipse evangelism, and a fundamentalist theology and strict political orthodoxy crushed and purged out anything other than it in Southern Baptist life. Don't get me wrong, the Southern Baptist realm I inhabited was always white, Christian, and conservative. This was the denomination, after all, that came into existence because it felt there was nothing inconsistent about white American slave owners whose slaves came from Africa becoming missionaries to go and evangelize people in Africa. I'm just saying that back then, converting the entire world to its particular form of Christianity would have been viewed by most Southern Baptists as more important than electing Republicans, even though most of them would want that as well. I grew up the son of a Southern Baptist minister who was conservative, but who believed in evangelizing the world. My father rejected people like Hal Lindsey and their crazy apocalyptic views of the world. He didn't really like Ronald Reagan that much, but he never would mention that in the churches he served. My dad was a company man, committed to the mission of evangelizing the world. So I grew up in churches where my dad was pastor, hearing about the Southern Baptist Convention's bold mission thrust, which, despite its clear sexual innuendo, had nothing to do with astronauts in a porn video. No, instead, bold mission thrust was the commitment by Southern Baptists to share the gospel with every person in the world by the year 2000. Now, by the actual year 2000, Southern Baptists had effectively split two, maybe three times into different groups. Some leaders in the SBC became hyper-Calvinists, believing in an extreme form of predestination. Why evangelize if God has already predetermined who is going to hell? Most of all, Southern Baptists by the year 2000, having had Clinton in the White House for most of the 90s, just seemed to drive them insane. They were driven into apoplectic fits of rage, with megachurch pastors attempting to outdo one another and their condemnations of the murdering, gays in the military promoting, baby-killing hippie occupying 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. Following Jesus began to look exactly like following Rush Limbaugh and Newt Gingrich. Growing up in the days when the goal of every Christian I knew was to evangelize the world rather than become members of the Tea Party, meant people who were not Christian, or even Christians who were not Southern Baptists, were only interesting in so much as they were future converts. Because they might think they were Christians, and they might even mean it, and be good-intentioned. But the fact is, if they had not accepted Jesus Christ as their personal Lord and Savior, then they weren't getting into heaven. There was no understanding that other people's worldviews and theologies, or lack of them, might constitute an equally viable point of view to my own. We were right, and they were wrong. We didn't necessarily want to be smug about it, but the world had only two kinds of people in it: Southern Baptists and maybe other Christians who weren't Southern Baptists, but nonetheless promoted accepting Jesus Christ as personal Lord and Savior, and then everybody else. As a child and young teen, I recall looking at the church signs of other congregations out the windows of our car as we drove to church. Methodists, Presbyterians, Lutherans were filled with people who might make it to heaven, but they were doing a lot of dangerous things like baptizing babies, or reciting creeds, or letting bishops tell them how to believe, or telling them who their ministers would be. Now, when I saw the Catholic Church signs out my car window on Sunday mornings, I knew they were a different matter altogether, since they prayed to Mary and to the saints rather than straight to God. We had something called the Priesthood of All Believers, which meant that we could pray directly to God, and God would forgive us directly. We did not need a priest of any kind to intercede on our behalf. Christ was our only priest. And those Catholics had their minds controlled by the Pope, anyway. They had no chance of avoiding the lake of fire. And what about the LDS congregations we passed on the way to my Southern Baptist church? Well, those Mormons, and the particular variety of them common out here in the Kansas City area, which were the Reorganized Church of the Latter-day Saints, since having changed their name to Community of Christ. Well, they were not real Christians at all, and those were not real churches, but rather cults. The different versions of Mormons that we have around here, all of them, were just like the Jehovah's Witnesses, evil incarnate, ready to snatch unsuspecting and unprepared Christians into their labyrinths of depravity. As far as members of non-Christian world religions go, I was not aware of any Muslims, Hindus, or Jews in my suburb of Kansas City, except for one classmate named Marcy. Marcy and I went to the same middle school, and as far as I can remember, she was the first Jewish person I ever met. She was also a cheerleader, popular, and as hot as sheet metal barn sides on a cloudy August day. I was a nerdy, non-athletic, and oh-so-uncool kid. I was the kid who always got whatever clothes that had been the latest fad only when they hit the sale racks when the fad was over. My first pair of parachute pants were worn a full year after the cool kids had them and after they had stopped wearing them. They were already on to acid-washed jeans by the time I showed up in my maroon nylon pants covered in zippers. Despite my pathetic fashion sense, poor bathing habits, and thick glasses, in my memory, Marcy had always been kind to me. I guess my hopeless crush on her, along with her being forbidden fruit as a daughter of Zion, overwhelmed any good sense I had, because one day, in a misguided attempt to, what, engage with her about monotheism, attempt the theological equivalent of pulling her pigtails during first grade recess? Demonstrate my alpha male religiosity? Apropos of nothing, I brought up her Jewishness. I recall standing in the school library and I said something to her along the lines of, "Well, you know, you aren't going to heaven because you don't believe in Jesus." That's just what every eighth grade girl wants to hear from suitors, that she's going to hell. Well, I remember Marcy turning on me and looking me straight in the eye without blinking and retorting, "Jews do believe in Jesus. We just believe that Jesus was a wise teacher, but not the Son of God." Well, what the hell was I supposed to say to that? Marcy had not been bowled over by my superior connection to God. And apparently she was okay with Jesus, just not in the Lord and Savior kind of way. Marcy did not immediately fall on her knees and accept Jesus Christ as her Lord and Savior. I don't know what I expected her to do, but what she had done was something I could never have foreseen. And after I said my snarky comment about her eternal salvation or lack thereof, I knew deep down inside of myself, in a way I could never articulate, that I was being an asshole. I had a crush on Marcy, despite her popularity, good looks, and being a cheerleader. She had been nice to a geek like me. Why was I being mean to her? Everything in the way I had been raised said that I was doing her a favor. I was helping her by leading her to realize her false beliefs and how she needed to change and not go to hell. But what I felt inside was that I was being a jerk. To this day, I wonder if at the Hebrew school Marcy attended, they taught her and her fellow students quick comebacks to anti-Semitic buttheads. I imagine them role-playing how to respond to dumbass Christians, calling them Christ killers, or bringing up the protocols of the elders of Zion. Such was her quick response, and her ability to respond to my ignorant Christian condescension with an answer that indicated self-assuredness, but not meanness. To her credit, my memories of Marcy after that encounter were of her continuing to be kind to me on all occasions. I guess her rabbi taught her to show love, even to close-minded boys raised as Southern Baptists. But unlike Marcy, showing kindness and respect towards people who didn't share my faith still remained elusive for me. Another memory I have of feeling both right and wrong about judging someone of another religious persuasion occurred during a conversation with the mother of a friend of mine. My friend Talisa had a set of parents who were loving and accepting of everyone, although they were stridently non-religious themselves. Just as teenage children of religious parents rebel by flirting with atheism or not going to church, so also, I've learned, teenage children of non-religious parents rebel by finding Jesus. And my friend Talisa and her older sister had become part of the youth group at a large Nazarene church nearby. So that by the time Talisa and I became friends in marching band, we both spoke the same language of Christian ease. Talisa's mother, Myra, was a sweet school teacher who accepted all of her daughter's friends as if they were her own kids. In their house, I experienced a kind of emotional openness I had never known in my own home, which was filled with unspoken tension and undercurrents of conflict. I loved and respected Myra, and I enjoyed the fact that at their house, they could be affectionate and could express kindness and emotions to one another in ways that in my family were completely foreign. And Myra taught me a lesson I've never forgotten. One day Myra and I were talking, and the subject of another girl in our school came up. Her name was Christy, and she had all-American girl next door looks, a winning personality, brains, and friendliness, but she was also a Mormon. So in my mind, she might as well have had a barbed tail and a pitchfork. In my memory, for some reason, we were speaking about Christy going on mission after high school, like all good Latter-day Saints do. I said something like, yeah, Christy's great, but it's too bad she's Mormon. To give a year or more of your life and service to a group like that, I can't imagine. As soon as the words left my mouth, I remember glancing at Myra as if looking for her agreement or maybe approval, and she frowned and was silent for a moment. And then she spoke as if choosing her words very carefully for me. She said, I would never want to disparage someone else's religious beliefs. Her words were spoken kindly, but they triggered my shame response immediately, which was strange, given that what I said was what I had been taught was right. Mormonism was wrong. What they believed was wrong, and it was dangerous. And not just dangerous with a lowercase d, but dangerous with a capital D, because what they were teaching could lead you into hell forever. But if what I said was right, then why would Myra, whom I respected, disapprove of them? I didn't know it then, but that moment of cognitive dissonance was a doorway cracking open to a different world. Myra didn't wish to disparage another person's religious views. Why ever not? I mean, that was how I had been raised, after all. Without disparaging other people's religious beliefs, how in the world would we know why we believe what we do, and more importantly, why it was correct? Also, implicitly, how else would we know we were superior to them? It was a genuinely new thought for me, this idea of not judging other people's religious practices and beliefs that were different from my own. I can still remember a book my father had bought for me with the best of intentions. It was a book put out by the Southern Baptist Home Mission Board, the agency that put out missionaries in the United States and Canada. I guess going down to Mexico meant you were going to a foreign country, but Canada was okay. Anyway, it was called Beliefs of Other Kinds, and it was spoken of in Southern Baptist circles in a shorthand way by its acronym BOOK. Beliefs of Other Kinds. It contained accessible articles on non-Southern Baptist Christian denominations, the various world religions such as Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, and Buddhism, as well as groups we considered cults such as Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, the Unification Church, or Moonies, and so on. Imagine the arrogance of putting out a book called Beliefs of Other Kinds, where everyone but Baptists are the other. Well, that was my worldview. And to shift towards seeing myself as a member of a religious tradition among many other religious traditions, each with their own truth claims, rather than as a member of the only true religious tradition in a world filled with false religions, was a major mind shift indeed. I'm not sure I have ever stopped wrestling with the ramifications of that shift. I'm pretty sure I have never stopped shifting. A major event on my journey towards religious humility came my freshman year in college. I attended a small private liberal arts college in East Tennessee, which happened to be Southern Baptist affiliated. Carson Newman College, since become Carson Newman University, actually provided, at the time, a pretty good liberal arts education. And rather than really brainwashing you in the way I imagine Bible colleges might do. I jumped in with both feet into that Baptist environment. I got involved in Baptist Student Union, and each spring break, college students who were a part of the BSU went on mission trips across the country. It felt like the utter idea of selfishness to take your spring break and go somewhere on a beach when you could be on a mission trip expanding the kingdom of God. And so that's what I did all the way through college. At the time, most of the teams were led by college students, literally with no college staff along to chaperone. From a perspective of over 25 years later, I wonder how the college kept its insurance, given the liability of a bunch of 18 to 22-year-olds piling into the college's 15-passenger vans, heading out to God knows where. Later on, my friends would use their Baptist Student Union connections to get a Carson Newman van and drive themselves down to Atlanta for a U2 concert. They were pretty loose rules on taking college property and heading out doing who knows what. But anyway, my freshman year, the Southern Baptist Home Mission Board had set up some mission trips for BSU members that involved dialogue with people of other religions. Now, dialogue probably meant figuring out ways to convert them, but at least it involved building some kind of relationship with them first. It was remarkable that only a few years after the fundamentalist staged a takeover of the Southern Baptist Convention, that any denominational-backed dialogue efforts could have ever have been put in motion. I guess some holdover from the days before the theocrats took over still thought there was a benefit to Southern Baptist and others getting to know other people as human beings and not just objects to convert. I feel sure whenever these trips were discovered by the fundamentalists, the program was cut and any record of them having ever occurred was destroyed. Carson Newman's BSU's dialogue trip was to travel to Detroit, Michigan, to dialogue with Muslims, most of whom were immigrants from Middle Eastern countries. The dozen college students, whom in this case were led by our BSU director, went on the trip with the idea that our job was to be kind and sensitive to the Muslims we met. But hey, if any got converted to Christianity, that was all the better. If we got some switched over to our team, then we really won. We visited mosques where we were greeted warmly because these Muslim immigrants knew they were outsiders in American culture and they welcomed any efforts at bridge building. This was a decade before 9/11, when most of us only knew about Islam from the Iran hostage crisis or suicide bombers in Lebanon. We'd had the first Gulf War happening around the same time and really had no clue the difference between Saddam Hussein and the Ayatollah Khomeini and Sunni and Shia Muslims and any of that. When we met our Muslim hosts at their mosques, they were very, very quick to differentiate themselves from the theocracy of Iran, from the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein. And they wanted us to understand that they believed in democracy and freedom, too. As a Southern Baptist who felt deep shame for struggling to have my quiet time of prayer and Bible reading each day, I couldn't help but be impressed by Muslims who prayed 5 times a day. I felt like even the best Christian prayer warriors I knew didn't get up before dawn to pray, or at 4 more times during the day, they would drop whatever they were doing to kneel and pray on the ground. The Muslims we met didn't seem to be pathological sinners or really lost at all. They seemed to have a deep sense of community and an even deeper sense of faith. The mosques we visited were packed with worshipers who all greeted us as if we were honored guests, although often with puzzlement, too, of what the heck we were doing there. After visiting one suburban mosque, a family invited us to their home the next day. Their well-appointed home in a well-to-do neighborhood was beautiful. They had ordered a huge spread of Middle Eastern food for us to eat, and they gave each member of our team a copy of the Quran, which had the Arabic and English translations side by side. Each volume was beautiful and looked expensive. I remember thinking what Christian family would show such generosity and hospitality to a group of Muslims who showed up at their church one Sunday. I couldn't think of a single Christian I knew who would do such a thing. In our meetings, we often asked them questions about whether they had a personal relationship with Allah the way we had with Jesus. We asked them about the verses in the Quran which talked about Jesus and his mother Mary, which actually gets a lot of play in the Quran. I remember thinking that I could somehow use their own holy book to trip them up and show them how they were living a lie and following a false religion. At one of the mosques, we met a young Muslim named Ratib. He was a dentistry major at Wayne State University in Detroit. He took a liking to us, and he was our age, and he also joined us on several other events afterward, often translating for us. He and I began talking, and I had a sense that God had placed him before me so that I might witness to him, and he might accept Jesus as his Lord and Savior. When our week in Detroit ended, we exchanged addresses, and I gave him my own Bible. It was called the Student Bible, put out by Zondervan, and it had all sorts of sidebars and inserts explaining difficult passages of Scripture, and was filled with passages I had underlined and highlighted with different colors of highlighter. I look back now and I can see the arrogance and the limited point of view of thinking that God had placed me in Ratib's life for a reason. It never once occurred to me that God might be placing Ratib in my life for a reason, and that maybe God had something that God wanted me to learn. Ratib and I wrote each other. Each of us were reading the other's holy book. I found the Quran slow going, even though it's much shorter than the Bible, but he dove into Genesis. He questioned me about the story of the Tower of Babel in Genesis 11, where humanity desires to become like God. They construct a tower that will reach up to heaven so they can become gods themselves. God seems angry, but also a little afraid that they might succeed. So he destroys the tower and scatters humanity throughout the earth, giving them different languages so they can never unite again and seek to usurp God's power. Ratib was really puzzled, because this story seemed to depict God as being frightened that humans might take God's power. He wrote to me that Allah would never be afraid that humans could become like gods. That simply wasn't possible. Humans were mortal and could never even hope to become like Allah. Allah would never be so weak to be afraid of puny humans. I remember reading Ratib's question and thinking in sheer terror he had a point. I had always learned that God was God, the most powerful, omnipotent being in the universe, and we were just mortals. But when I read Genesis 11, it sure seems to say that God says to whomever God is speaking to, those humans are going to get up here to heaven and become gods themselves. Why would God be afraid of humans building some tower to heaven and taking God's power? God looked like an insecure mean girl swatting down a less popular girl's attempt to rise through the high school social strata. But but it was in the Bible. There was no denying it. But compared to Allah, my God seemed like a punk. My understanding of the Bible at that time didn't allow me a way out from Rateeb's questions. I hadn't learned to understand the first 11 chapters of Genesis as mythopoetic stories passed down through oral tradition. I didn't understand the story of the Tower of Babel as a mythic exploration of humanity's destructive pride, and simultaneously an explanation for why cultures and languages that were different from one another existed. I had no other way to view this story other than as literal history. So if I had no answer for Rateeb, his God seemed greater than my God. He won because he had the better argument, and I lost, and that was unacceptable. Most importantly, I hadn't learned how to say simply the four words, I don't know. Wait, that's three. Rateeb also mailed me a videotape of a debate, if you want to call it that, between a Muslim writer named Ahmed Didat, who sought to reveal the false nature of Christianity as opposed to the true religion of Islam. Didat was basically the equivalent of a Muslim fundamentalist evangelical. So it was fitting that the debate was between him and televangelist Jimmy Swaggart. Held before Swaggart's outing as a customer for prostitutes, which resulted in him on TV crying red-faced, "I have sinned." In this so-called debate, Swaggart basically tried to convert Didat, and the Muslim writer basically punched holes in evangelical Christianity. The many brutal uppercuts and body blows he delivered to Swaggart were the common criticisms of Christianity that everybody from Nietzsche to Sartre to Christopher Hitchens all have made. Swaggart looked like a chump, and even my evangelical self knew Swaggart was an idiot. Yet this was one more swipe at my faith that I didn't have another answer for. In the contest of whose religion was better, Rateeb seemed to have backed the winner. So I'm embarrassed to say I never wrote him back, because I thought it was my job to win the contest and prove him and his faith wrong. It just never occurred to me to have some humility, to admit that I didn't have answers to his questions, but to continue to search for them. It never occurred to me to continue our relationship with humility, because for me, it was a zero-sum game. Winner takes all, and if I couldn't win and defend Christianity, then I wouldn't play. Over the years, I think I have learned to admit when I didn't have answers for other people's honest questions about God, Christianity, and faith in general. I think I've learned on my better days that it is entirely possible that I am a Christian because I was raised in the home of a Southern Baptist minister, and my neural pathways, which allow for theism, were created early in my child brain. Perhaps I am conditioned to believe in God and be a Christian. Perhaps my belief in God is a coping mechanism for dealing with the prospect of a cold and random universe and my own mortality, which ends with my final breath. Perhaps I am too afraid of there being no life after death to truly engage with the prospect of that possibility. Perhaps if I were raised in Saudi Arabia, I would be Muslim, or in India, I'd be Hindu, or Japan, I'd be Shinto. All of these perhaps could be true, and I could be deluding myself. And to this pile of possible alternative realities, the possibility that another religion has it right and I've got it wrong could be added. I prefer now to think of it as some of us may have it more right than others, maybe, and a little more truth than others, maybe, but none of us have it all, and none of us have more truth in a way that should lead us to be arrogant, or worse, abusive. I've preferred to think of humanity's search for something more, something transcendent. In that phrase that somebody wrote, I don't know who, that we're all just beggars telling other beggars where to find a crust of bread. And that seems to me to be about right. I do believe now that anytime someone is loving, kind, and compassionate, I understand it that the Spirit of God is at work in them, whether or not that person gives any thought to God at all, even if they're militantly anti-religion. I also believe that anytime someone is hateful, unkind, or cruel, even if they claim to be the most faithful Christian in the world, their cruelty has everything to do with them and not the God revealed in Jesus's sacrificial love. I no longer view faith as a contest, nor do I believe the world is divided up into people who think like me and everyone else who is the other. I found connection and admiration for people who claim many other faiths and with those who claim none. Mostly, I'm trying just to direct my energy towards being serious about what I claim to believe, instead of avoiding my own spiritual self by judging and trying to one-up others. The only people I still get stuck on judging are people who use my faith, my Jesus, my God, to hurt others. When I read the Gospels, I tend to think Jesus was pretty judgmental of them, too. One might think that I would be more compassionate towards Christian evangelicals and fundamentalists because I once believed as they do. I'm sure the way of less judgment is better than more, but I'd like to think that all along, deep down inside me, there was some part of me, some part created in the image of God that was always in me, which knew it was always wrong to condemn others for being different from me. And maybe that part of me, that part created in the image of God, which has always been there, will still speak to me along my journey and will help me finding my way to a God who resonates with that kind-hearted part of myself, which has always been there. I don't know, maybe because of that kind-hearted part of me, that part of the image of God, one day I'll look back on this podcast, making fun of Christians both like and unlike me, and maybe then I'll look back at this and wince at my arrogance. In the meantime, I'm going to keep working on my next podcast sponsorship, parodying the Christians whom I judge with the bitter, sarcastic, and cynical humor I've got. More sin scanners, more fake holy water, more crap from Crokesbury books, because at least for now, even if I regret it later, it amuses me and makes me feel, I have to admit, a little bit better than them.